Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hello, I'm Gary Bloom. Welcome to On the Sporting Couch. I'm a psychotherapist, counsellor and broadcaster, and that means I work one-to-one with all sorts of people who are having or have experienced problems in their day-to-day lives. It's sometimes called a talking therapy. It doesn't mean the individual is ill, but the sessions give people the opportunity to talk about the things that are really affecting them and gives them a chance to get things off their chest. I treat people suffering from anxiety, depression, addictive behaviours and relationship issues. All of us will know of someone going through a tough time, and hopefully this series will encourage anyone who feels like they need to get help. There are some useful links on the TalkSport website and we'll give these out at the end of the show. I'm undertaking the project to help widen the understanding of mental well-being in sport, and hopefully this programme will give a greater understanding of what goes on between therapist and the sports person who today is on the sporting couch. Meet Ewan Thomas, who for 3 years was one of the fastest 400-metre sprinters this country has ever produced. He burst onto the athletic scene in the mid-1990s, winning silver in the 4x400-metre relay for the Olympic Games in Atlanta, and then a string of gold medals at the World Championships in Athens, European Championships in Budapest, and Commonwealth Games in Kuala Lumpur, to mention a few. But a series of injuries took away his athletic prowess, and as soon as the success had arrived, it faded, leaving Ewan to deal with the end of his career in his late 20s. This was a difficult time for Ewan, and he suffered from depression, but he came to terms with his injuries and has now forged a new career as a TV presenter. Welcome to On the Sporting Couch with me, Gary Bloom, and former Olympic athlete Ewan Thomas, who said to me that he bitterly regretted never having had one last great success at the end of his career. You said something to me the other day which I really identified with, and you said it's really hard sometimes when you're up for TV work and auditioning and all that sort of stuff when you're rejected. And I thought, yeah, I know exactly what that feels like. Does it get any easier?
I think it's weird because as an athlete, the stopwatch never lied. So if you run fast, the selectors, if they like you or not, they've got to pick you. You know, it's black and white. You've either won a race or you haven't. You've done enough to qualify for championships. But I think since I've retired, going into sort of media and television work, it's purely subjective. So you might think the last job you did, you were amazing. You really nailed it. You know, you did it well. And then the phone might not ring for a while. So I think it's kind of quite an insecure sort of career to go into, in terms of there's a lot of waiting around. When things are great, they're brilliant. But then there are a lot of downtime when you don't have work. And I think that's a period of time when you're fighting your demons a little bit. You know, you've got to just stick in there and, you know, you're going to turn the corner.
Tell me about the demons.
Well, I say demons, that sounds a bit strong, but
I've got my demons.
Yeah, well, I think I'm one of those people who, don't get me wrong, I love a day off, and I love nothing more than, say, maybe 2 or 3 days watching films on the sofa, but then that soon gets boring, and then I soon think, crikey, why am I not working? What's the next thing coming in? And I think you just become a little bit insecure, really. It's not a normal 9-to-5 job where you know where you're going to be. Mm. Not that I'd really think I'd enjoy that so much, because I quite like the thrill of, you know, different work coming in and every day being different. But I do think it can be an industry where, as I said, you're left thinking quite a lot why you didn't get that particular gig when you think you would have been great for it. But then on the flip side, there's other jobs that come in and I think, wow, didn't expect I'd get that, and really happy to be involved with that. So it's a weird industry.
The word I'm going to pick out of the last answer is thrill. What does a thrill mean to you, and how important has that been in your career?
It's been everything in my career. A thrill is an excitement. It's a buzz. It's a natural drug going through your veins when you just... It's a high. So that would be winning a race. That would be finishing a training session full of lactic acid, really hurting, but knowing you've run really fast times since retirement. That might be riding a motorbike faster than you should do, or, you know, something that scares you. I spoke to a mate actually on the way here, and he invited me to come and do a parachute jump with, I think he said, the Red Devils, some proper hard SAS lot. And I was like, I'm scared of heights. And a few years ago, I was actually in South Africa for a long weekend, and I thought, right, I need to face my fears. And two things I'm really scared of are big sharks and heights. So I swam with great white sharks and I jumped out of a plane, because that's my character, you know, in terms of I like to push myself. And that was a thrill. It wasn't a thrill I enjoyed, in particular the parachute jump, but it was perhaps a way of replacing that buzz of being an athlete. When that's taken away from you, I found that very hard to deal with for many years, that I will no longer get those plaudits where you're walking through Heathrow Airport and some security men are like, oh, watched you last night, beat the Americans, wicked, great race. The pride you feel to be a British athlete and representing your country and doing well, when that's gone, it's difficult. And I'm sure many sportsmen and women will feel exactly the same as me.
Does anything ever replicate that moment seconds before a big race, when you're waiting to hear the starter say marks? Does anything ever replicate that again?
No, the only thing that comes close would be something like live television, you know, in your ear when you're counting down, coming back off the advert, off the brakes, or maybe lining up to do Strictly. You're about, you know, just that adrenaline, knowing, crikey, it doesn't matter how hard you've trained, how good you think you are, it all comes down to this moment. This is live. If you mess it up, you're an idiot. You know, you're going to look a fool. Whereas as an athlete, if you mess it up, you're just going to be angry at yourself that you've trained so hard. And that was one of the things I loved as an athlete, where a race didn't go well, and trust me, I lost more races than I won, I actually, after the initial disappointment, quite liked the feeling of going training the next day thinking, I never want to feel like that again. I never want to go off too fast and blow up at the end, or I never want to go too slow and leave too much to do in the last 50 metres. You know, so you kind of learn from your mistakes as an athlete. And I kind of liked all the things really that I used to moan about when I was an athlete. Now it's gone. I look back and I miss that. You know, the travelling, the training with the mates. The training was so hard for the 400 metres, but I find it hard to replace that pain, that thrill of having pain in my body. I still train now, obviously to a lot lesser standard, but I used to really enjoy that part of my athletics, the hurting yourself, if that makes sense, in training.
Two things came up for me when I hear you say those words. One is the masochism of the pain, and the other one is, are you addicted to the buzz? Yeah. It's an addiction.
It must be.
Let's start with the addiction to the buzz, and I can see how the television would replicate that the buzz you'd get from racing. What happens when the buzz isn't there?
You have to try and replace that buzz somehow. But
how do you do
that? My buzzer doesn't buzz as loud anymore. You know, there's nothing. There's nothing that has replaced that feeling that sport gave me. That's why maybe I try and do things that scare me, like, as I said, ride motorbikes, do track days in my car, jump out of aeroplanes, whatever it might be. Maybe I'm still looking, maybe I'm searching for that replacement, but I don't think it will ever come, unfortunately. But I'm better than I used to be. You know, I accept I'm no longer an athlete, but when I first had to retire because of injuries, for many years I kept looking back at my event, and this is no disrespect to people who run my event now, but I've held the British record 20 years, and for the first at least 5 years of stopping running, I still thought I could beat them. I still thought, maybe I should try. Maybe I should try. And I probably couldn't have done, but in my mind I was thinking, if my body can just hold out, hold through those injuries, I think I could still do it. But I couldn't, but in my head I thought I could. And maybe I'm that Peter Pan character. Maybe I need to grow up and I still think I'm really young. But I have accepted now, obviously, there's no way at 43 I could compete how I used to. But for many years I did, you know, hate my body for giving up on me, you know, having injuries and being forced to retire. I used to just think, why me? Especially, with all due respect, athletes who I used to race against had failed drugs tests, and I thought, you know, all I was doing was training my hardest to be the best I could be, and my body let me down. Whereas why can people be out there cheating and having a much longer career than me? They had longevity of 10 years, right? 3 good years, and that was it for me. So I think I felt a lot of anger towards other athletes when I retired. I just felt it wasn't fair on me. But then I've grown to accept maybe that was my path. Maybe just being an athlete was a part of my life. Maybe I'll go on to do bigger and better things. And that was just my stepping stone.
I'd like to talk about the masochism. Is it there in other areas of your life? Do you beat yourself up? Do you allow others to beat you up?
Well, obviously people can't see, but I'm covered in tattoos. I've got a lot of tattoos, and I do think, if I'm honest, perhaps that is a part of... I don't want to say self-harming, but tattoos really... Have you got any tattoos? No, you don't look like a man who would, but tattoos hurt. Tattoos very much hurt, and I'll do at least 6 or 7 hours per sitting. And you know, some people can take painkillers or have numbing cream. I refuse any of that because I think if I want that ink on my body, I deserve to go through the pain. It's a story. But, you know, perhaps subconsciously there's something in that where, you know, the pain of having a tattoo is some form of, I don't know, not, I wouldn't say bars because it's not a nice pain, but...
Are you proud of those tattoos?
Yeah, I am, yeah. My parents hate my tattoos and certainly different generations don't like them, but I have them where I can hide them. You know, I have them so if I wear a shirt on television, you wouldn't know I had any tattoos. I'd never cover my arms with them, but, you know, they're there. But, you know, I don't know. I spoke to one of the tattoo guys in the shop the other day and I said, do you think it's kind of like a form of self-harm? And he said, yeah, definitely. I have people who come in here who want to hurt themselves. And it sounds really weird. Like, why would you want to do that? Because... I don't want to self-harm, but maybe the tattoos for me are a way of not only expressing myself and it's individuality, all my tattoos mean something to me, but maybe there is something in there whereby a tattoo is a form of, I don't know, addiction.
Give me a little bit of a thumb sketch, very brief, about your family of origin.
Okay, so mum, dad, brother. My dad was in the forces, so he was away a lot. Pretty strict with me. I was a mummy's boy. My brother went to boarding school at quite a young age. We both had the option to do that. I didn't want to do that. So I went to the local comprehensive. My dad worked away a lot. So mainly I grew up, I suppose, with my mum from the age of about 12. My brother was also a good athlete. Could have been really good. I went to the English schools for the 2 and the 400 metres. And then I came along, you know, a couple of years younger than him. Actually ended up going to his boarding school on a weird twist of fate. My parents moved abroad. Then I broke his school records, which I don't think went down too well. We've never spoke about it, but we're very different. My brother's a great guy. My dad's a brilliant bloke. My dad has been so supportive in terms of all through my university, you know, financially helped me. And then when I finished uni, it was clear I could do something in athletics. I'd got to the Commonwealth Games. I'd run a Welsh record. I ran 45.9, which was getting there. It was still about a second slower than Roger Black and the best in the world. But I knew, with all due respect, I wasn't training at uni. I was going out most of the time. So my parents were like, oh, aren't you doing well, juggling your studies and training? And it just got to the point at the end of my degree, this is before National Lottery funding, my dad was like, listen, I'll financially help you for a year if you want to move to the South Coast to live near Mike Smith, who was my coach. He was a fantastic coach. You get yourself a part-time job, I'll pay your rent for a year. So if my dad hadn't done that and been kind to support me and let me chase my dream, then I wouldn't have become a professional athlete.
This is On the Sporting Couch, a programme about mental health issues in sport. I'm psychotherapist Gary Bloom, and my guest here in the studio is former Olympic sprinter Ewan Thomas. Welcome back. You're listening to On the Sporting Couch with me, Gary Bloom, and former Olympic sprinter Ewan Thomas. Are you motivated when somebody says, you can't do that, Ewan?
Yeah, definitely.
Why?
It's what gets me going.
Tell me why.
Just to prove people wrong. If someone says I can't do something, I'll do it. And normally, sometimes that'll get me in trouble. It's not always sensible things, but I just think we've all got barriers in life and I don't like people putting them in front of me. I'll put my own barriers in front of me, and if someone tells me I can't do something, I'll be very determined to prove they're incorrect and I can do it.
So where are your barriers?
I don't know.
Because you've got to put your own barriers in place to look after yourself.
Yeah, maybe that's one of my problems. Maybe I put my barriers too high. I don't know, maybe... Well, maybe I'm searching for that barrier. Where is my breaking point? I don't know, but I always try and be the best that I can be in anything I do, be it television presenting, running, whatever I do. I always try and be the best.
And is that search for the barrier being detrimental in your personal relationships?
Oh, 100%. Definitely. I've been so selfish. I think as a sportsman coming from an individual sport, as I said, where you're judged by your performances. You can't hide behind your the rest of your football team or your rugby team, or, you know, if it goes well, it's all on you. If it goes badly, it's all on you. So I think as an athlete, you have to be very focused. All sports people do, but I think you've really, you are in the spotlight. And I think for me, I've always put myself first, and that's something I've addressed recently. You know, I've always had to put myself first because of my career. And I think that has definitely ruined relationships in the past, and it's probably not made me the easiest person to live with.
How would other people describe you?
Focused, determined, single-minded.
Are you proud of those? Are you proud of those descriptions?
Yeah, I think so. I've always been this way, though. From even a very young age, I did BMX racing from the age of 9. Mm-hmm. And quite soon I did well on that in terms of they built a BMX track in my parents' village. My babysitter one night said, oh, have you heard they're building a BMX track? You should get a bike for Christmas. So I got a second-hand BMX for Christmas. And then I started racing. And in that first year, I was number 2 in the country. I came 4th in the European Championships. And it was quite clear that for me, I'm not saying I wasn't academic, but sport was a way out for me. Or it was a way of showing off and being accepted, if I'm honest. At my school, you know, everybody knew me for sport, and I was quite cheeky at school, but I never once had a detention. You know, when I say cheeky, I'd be playing practical jokes on teachers, and it was almost like, oh yeah, he's all right. He plays for the county, rugby, football, cross country. You know, it was almost like they were proud of what I did on the sports field, so I got away with murder in the classroom. And I think that's why I like sport, because it gave me a way of showing my mates I was better than them. Not in a horrible way, but I think as a youngster, you just want to show off, don't you? You want to be the fastest kid in the playground.
I hear you're great at BMX. I hear you're great at rugby. I hear you're great at athletics. There's a whole bunch of stuff. What happens when you're not good at something?
Oh, you haven't seen me play tennis. Any racket sports, I'm absolutely useless.
And how do you feel about that when you can't do something brilliantly? Like, you're a great television presenter. Everything you seem to turn your hand to, you seem to be able to do well. What happens when you can't do something well?
I just pretend I don't like it, so I don't take it up. Like golf, I'm rubbish at golf. But it's only because I don't play enough time playing golf. I'd probably be better than I am. No, I think... No, I'm not brilliant at everything. There's no way I am, but I like to try and be the best that I can be in whatever I do. And if it's a sport, for example, I know I'm naturally not coordinated out or I'm not very good at, then I won't concentrate on that. I'll concentrate on what I do like and what I enjoy because I'm good at it.
But can you see you, and you're describing things you're good at in terms of sports.
Yeah.
I'm wondering about the personal side of your life, the relationships, you as a son, you as a partner. What happens when you struggle in those situations?
I think I could definitely, there's room for improvement as a son. I don't see my parents enough. But I know they're proud of me, you know, and I'm not a bad son at all. You know, I think I'm quite a good son. I think I can be a bit grumpy sometimes when I go home to my mum and dad. It's nice for the first couple of days, and then you remember why you no longer live at home. But no, I don't think that if they were sat here now, I hope they'd tell you they're extremely proud of me. I think I'm a good person. I've made mistakes in my life, but I don't, away from the sport, I truly don't think I'm a bad person.
I don't think it's about being good or bad. It's the standards you set for yourself, it strikes me, are incredibly high. And I'm wondering what happens to you when you don't quite reach those magical standards that you set. What happens to you then as an individual?
Disappointment. Certainly disappointment. And, I get my down days, don't get me wrong. There's days when I'm disappointed and I'm all right off it because I think, it's cool, I can rectify that situation. But then when it's taken out of my hands, definitely there'd be days when I feel severe disappointment if I'm not very good at something or something hasn't gone my way when I think it should have gone better.
It's the same
for everyone, I think. Disappointment's hard to take, isn't it? And it's how you bounce back from that. And as an athlete, I think I learned so much more from losing races and from being injured and having to spend seasons on the sideline watching. I learned more from those years, probably now looking back at it, hated it at the time, than the years when they went really well and I was winning all the races and doing well. You're just riding the crest of a wave. You don't really learn much, I don't think, from that. It's when you face difficulties, and it's the same for any walk of life. It's not just sport. I think it's when you come up against barriers, you learn more about yourself.
You strike me as the golden boy of athletics. You come into the sport, the world juniors, you're suddenly at the Olympics, silver medal in the 4x4, and then it all comes to a shuddering halt. What happened to you psychologically at that moment?
Oh, yeah, that was horrendous. So, like, 1998, the year could not have gone any better. Won the European Championships, Commonwealth Games, World Cup. I thought, this is it. Come Sydney. I knew Michael Johnson would retire after Sydney. And then 1999, I had a really bad stress fracture. Turned into like a cyst in the bone, and I was out for a whole year, and I never got back to running those good times. And I think that was the worst bit, accepting that my body could no longer train 6 days a week, and I could only maybe train twice a week on the track. And doesn't matter how naturally talented you think you are, it's a big world out there, and unless you're putting the work in, there's a lot of talented athletes you're going to be coming up against. So that was horrible, just because I felt let down by my body. Regret that I probably didn't listen to my body more when I was fit, in terms of I trained through injuries and just think I was invincible, which turned into bigger injuries, and I had lots of time out. So that was really hard. Those were the darkest years for me, when I got injured and when I realised I would no longer be able to compete at that highest level. I didn't know what I was going to do with my life at all. That was definitely some bad times.
Where were you in your darkest moments then?
What, mentally, you mean? Yeah, low. Definitely depressed. Didn't speak to anyone about it. My ex-girlfriend at the time knew, because she lived with me, but I would put on a happy face if I had to go in to have physio or anything like that. I'd be upbeat and tell everyone I was all right. I found it very hard to tell my parents and my friends how I felt, because for me it was a sign of weakness to admit I was down. And I know now it's not, and it's good to talk about that. That's why I'm here, to hopefully help others realise it's cool to talk about depression. But I think for me, what was hard is my friends aren't in the spotlight. My friends are just brilliant, regular guys, taxi drivers, people who cut the grass for the council, you know, just nice people who look up to me for what I've achieved in sport. And I felt I could never tell them how low I was feeling, because in their eyes, my life's hunky-dory, my life's brilliant, I've done well for myself. So for me, it was almost like I felt I couldn't share my misery with others, because what did I have to be miserable about? Although I was hurting inside, I thought others would look at me and think, but your life's good.
But you were miserable because you couldn't run as quick as you could.
Yeah. But they wouldn't see it as that, I don't think. Perhaps they would. They would see it as, you know, you had some great years.
But say the taxi driver, he would be miserable if he said, well, you can't drive your cab anymore, or the man cutting the grass, you can't cut the grass anymore. You were in exactly the similar situation.
Yeah, the two I mentioned there are both athletes. So we trained together, so they do understand, but they didn't reach the heights I did. So I think for them, I would have felt guilty putting my traumas on them, you know. I would have felt guilty to do that.
So you've got this fantastic supportive family, and you've painted a very good picture of that, Ewan. And yet when the chips are down and you're going through a terribly dark phase of your life, you don't talk to them. And that's the bit I don't understand.
I wouldn't want them to worry. I want them to know that I'm doing all right.
You'd think they didn't know?
Yeah, they know. Obviously, they knew I was injured, but they probably didn't know how low I was feeling. You know, I wouldn't tell them, you know, I'll just, yeah, my injury's okay, should be back training in a month or whatever. You know, I think maybe that's the selfish side of me, but wanting to protect them, wanting to protect others around me. I didn't want them to have to sort of feel my pain, if that makes sense. I at the time, I felt I was doing the right thing. And also, you're talking about the late 90s, early 2000s, where I don't think people talk so much. You know, and I know that's, and maybe it's a bloke thing, maybe it's just me trying to be a macho guy and like not want to show my emotions, not want to show my disappointments or my downfalls. So maybe I didn't want to share my troubled times with people because I wanted them to all think I was okay.
Would your dad have listened?
Of course, yeah, definitely. My dad would have listened, my mum would have listened. But it's almost like it's not a subject I wanted to talk to them about. I didn't want them to see me in pain.
They saw you struggling now, you know, your television career took a dip for 6 months, and you said to them, Mum and Dad, I'm going through a terrible time. What would they say now?
They'd say, good, you need some time off. You work too hard. Seriously, they probably would. They're always telling me to slow down a little bit.
Why?
Because I think life passes you by quite fast, and I don't sit still.
Are they worried?
I'm quite hyperactive. Are they worried? Yeah, I think my dad tells me often that I need to slow down a little bit. But I think I'm a bit of a, maybe it's searching for that buzz, I think I'm a bit of a workaholic. So, you know, like I said, this industry, when it's great, it's great. You don't know what's around the corner. So I often think, not take every job that comes in whatsoever, but I do think if it's there and I fancy doing it, do it.
I tell you, the impression I have being with you, Ewan, is you're going at a huge speed. You're going at 400 miles an hour, and I'm struggling to keep up with you. And I'm wondering if that speed is covering some really difficult feelings And very many people do this. They're busy, busy, busy. You know, they've got busy jobs in the city and here and there and everywhere. And they create the busyness to stop feeling something that's really, really troubling them. Do you think, does that ring a bell for you?
Maybe. I'm definitely happiest when I'm busy. Yeah, I'm definitely happiest
when
I'm
busy. Can you feel the speed that I'm talking about?
But I'm quite hyperactive. So, like, I normally talk quite fast. Or if I'm on a night out, I'll drink my drinks quicker than my mates. It's not searching. I just think... I've not been diagnosed with ADHD, but I've got something. Even from my childhood, I was very hyper, and I think I just live like that. I think my brain's quite fast in terms of I'm always, not searching, but I like to be busy. I like to be a bit scatty. I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing.
And what happens when it just all slows down and there's nothing and it's just a night in front of the TV or a pair of your slippers and pyjamas night?
Yeah, but that's a weird thing. I also really like that. I could happily have a whole day at home watching films, sat on the sofa for 4 hours, and I'll feel great. But if that continues for too many days in a row, then I don't like it.
So we're back to the catastrophic thinking again, isn't it? It's going to be 200 miles an hour, 400 miles an hour, or absolutely nothing.
There's no middle ground, no. I think you're right.
This is On the Sporting Couch, a programme about mental health issues in sport. I'm psychotherapist Gary Bloom, and my guest here in the studio is former Olympic sprinter Ewan Thomas. Welcome back. You're listening to On the Sporting Couch with me, Gary Bloom, and former Olympic sprinter Ewan Thomas. One of the things you said to me in our conversation the other day was, one of my biggest regrets is I never had the final hurrah. Due to injuries, it all just fizzled away.
Yeah, that's tough. That was tough. You know, I have so much admiration and respect for people like, say, Jessica Ennis Hill, who retired under her terms, you know, retired at the top. And it's very hard to do that. Look at Usain Bolt this year. He should have quit last year, 100%. His body didn't want that last year. But for whatever reasons, he came to London to the World Champs and finished laid on a track injured, you know. It won't change his legacy. It won't change what he's done. But for me, I didn't even have that chance to get on that big stage again. I desperately wanted to try and finish my career on a high note. I'd been injured. I'd moved away from Mike, so I moved back to Southampton for the 2006 Commonwealth Games. I was selected to go to Melbourne in Australia. And 2 weeks before I'm due to get on the plane, that exact situation whereby I was training, my hamstring was a bit tight, and I said to Mike, I'm going to have to stop now. My hamstring's tight. You're going to come on, it's your last session before you get on the plane. One more rep, tore my hamstring, never stepped on a track again. And that was bitterly disappointing, not to be able to retire at a major championships, hopefully, on the top of that rostrum. That was really bad. In fact, I never officially retired. I just sort of walked away from the sport.
Fizzled out sounds really, really painful.
That's what happened. I definitely fizzled out in terms of, for me, the hardest thing to accept was I wasn't running 44.3 anymore. I was running 46.3, and that's all my body could handle because I could only train a few days a week. I was getting beaten by people, with all due respect, who I used to beat by 10 metres. I wasn't representing my country anymore, and I just kept thinking, one more winter, I can get back, and I never did. It was tough.
Let's go back to what we were saying before about this desire for speed to cover up some difficult feelings. You said to me before this recording began, you're not going to make me cry, are you? Are you frightened of showing your emotions?
No, I'm not frightened. I'm just in a good mood today and I don't want to cry. I have to go back on the train with red eyes. No, I'm not afraid to show my emotions, no. Perhaps in the past I have been trying to portray that big, strong bloke image. I definitely have. But you catch me at home watching a film on my own, I'll be in tears. I am an emotional person, but I think, once again, when you've had to make a career out of being physically and mentally stronger than those around you, it is quite hard for me anyway to open up to people. But I think I'm better than I used to be. I wouldn't be here talking to you now if I wasn't willing to open up. I just don't think I want to cry. Not yet.
It's your choice, and it's absolutely fine either way. I suppose my question would be, what would you like to say to the big, strong man who put on that big act?
It's not. There's no weakness in showing you're feeling low or you're upset. I think things are better now for people, but I think in the past it very much has been, maybe it's sexist saying it or it's old-fashioned, but blokes don't cry. But I think, you know, for me, without a doubt, going through those times when I bottled it up, when I was feeling low, it would have been better to talk about it. 100% it would have been better to talk about it. And I think it's brilliant nowadays that people, you know, feel they can, you know, due to charities like Heads Together with Prince Harry and high profile people coming out saying they've had depression, they've had hard times. It makes it acceptable to talk about, and it is acceptable. It doesn't matter what you do for a living. We all are going to face down days. I've never met anyone who's totally happy all the time, and if they are, they're lucky. I think, you know, we all struggle in life at times, and I think it's good to talk about it, and it's okay to open up. And don't matter if you're 6'4", don't matter how big you are or how strong you think you are, it's okay to... It's not weakness. It's okay to open up.
Was that meeting with Prince Harry the first time that you had really begun to open up to anybody about your personal life?
Yeah, it was, and it was very random opening up to a prince while we were being filmed, but it was just felt really natural. He invited me to a barbecue, and I was at the barbecue, we're flipping burgers, and he starts talking to me about, you know, as an athlete, injuries and how did it affect me, and I just found myself, he's such a nice guy, I just found myself talking to him as I am to you now and saying, yeah, I had some really horrible times and I found it really difficult, and I think it made me realise, wow, if he can talk about times he's had, and he's so under the spotlight with the media, then I think it really made me feel, why on earth haven't you talked before? And I think if anyone listening to this has a problem, you'll have a friend, you'll have a work colleague, you'll have family, someone to listen to you and talk, because if you bottle it up, it's not going to get any easier. You do need to talk about things, and I think gone are the days where it is a weakness to show. You know, I thought it was weak of me to admit I had a chink in my armour. You know, I had something that wasn't strong in my makeup. And I think it's fine to talk about that. And if anything, it's good to talk about it. And that's why, definitely, by me doing things like this, talking to you today, if I can only reach one person out there that turns to their wife, to their boyfriend, whoever it might be, and says, I've had a bad day at work, I'm really low at the moment, then I've done a good job. You've done a good job. You know, it's good to get it out.
I'm just wondering why you didn't go see a therapist at the time when it was at its worst.
I wasn't really aware of that. We had sports psychologists or whatever you want to call them, but that was more talking about focusing for the race. And to be honest, that was one of my strengths, was my strength, my mental strength. As an athlete, when things were going well, I didn't have to speak to anyone. I had to listen to a bit of music as I warmed up and I was ready to take on the world. I was very, very confident in my ability. When it wasn't going well, as I said, I didn't really want to accept that I was in pain inside, but I didn't really feel there was that support network out there. I'm sure it was, but I wasn't aware of it. And that's not being nasty to British Athletics. I'm sure if I'd contacted them and told them, they would have helped me. But I didn't think I wanted help. I didn't feel I needed help. And the worst thing with injuries, no one else understands. As I said, bless him, my coach would be like, how bad is it? And I say, well, I think I've torn something. Well, you seem all right. Come on. He wasn't an athlete. He doesn't know what a strained hamstring feels like or when you rupture your Achilles or something horrific. No one else can really feel what you feel inside, and then it becomes very personal.
I mean, you talk about your coach, Mike Smith, as being brilliant. And there's a bit of me that thinks, actually, there's a bit of cruelty there.
No, I wouldn't say cruelty. No, he was old-fashioned. No, he was very old-fashioned with his training methods. And because he hadn't been an athlete himself, he didn't know what really your body was feeling like, if that makes sense. So I don't, you know, a lot of coaches nowadays, it's a lot more scientific. They've been athletes themselves. They know if you've got a tight hamstring, rest. You know, don't finish a session. But for Mike, bless him, he hadn't been an athlete at a high level, so he didn't really understand. I just think he was a brilliant coach, a brilliant trainer, but perhaps didn't really understand disappointment that well, and that he was an old man. You know, he wasn't from the modern world.
But you stick with a coach who is prepared to go with you in punishing yourself. Can you see what I'm saying? It's a good fit in many respects.
He was a great coach.
He was a great coach for you because you wanted to push your body.
Yeah.
He wanted to push your body to be beyond what it was capable of.
Yeah.
And you can see how that fits together.
He was like a father figure to me. He was like a dad to me. He was more than a coach. He was brilliant. And his training methods definitely suited my mental state, if you want, or how I wanted to train.
And I'm going to pick you up on the fact he was a bit like a dad to me, because you have said that Dad was not around. He was a military man.
Yeah.
And he was not always there for you. Is that where the vacuum began to be created that Mike came into?
No, because at that stage I'd left home anyway and I'd finished university, so I only met Mike, you know, when I was early 20s, 21, 22. But I didn't know many people in Southampton when I lived there. He found me a little bedsit to rent. You know, his wife used to make me dinners. You know, he was brilliant for me because I was still juggling, if I'm honest. I was still wanting to be the eternal student. I didn't really know if I could make it in athletics. I was tempted to go out three nights a week still and go out and be a young lad about town. Whereas Mike would, you know, be knocking on my door, right, come on, training tonight, you know, and he knew exactly how to push my buttons. If I looked like I wasn't training hard one day, he'd tell me, oof, I've heard Mark Richardson and Jamie Balsh are in great shape. Oh, Roger Black did 6.2s yesterday, averaged 22.1. He didn't know that at all, but I believed him, so it made me run even faster. So he knew exactly what switch to flick, you know, in terms of to get me training hard. He knew what to say to me, and he was brilliant for me.
So you found somebody who fitted your masochistic model.
100%, yeah.
Have you never realised that until today?
No, I never realised that. No.
What does it feel like now that I've actually, you know, fed the material back to you and you can begin to understand it?
I'm smiling because it all makes total sense now. Why I loved Mike. It makes total sense why he was one of the most important people in my life and always will be, because we were a perfect match for each other.
I don't want to stop you smiling.
Yeah.
What did it feel like when he was coming to the end of his life?
Horrible. You're not going to make me cry. I went to see him in his care home. And I went there with my little dog, my puppy. We went to see him, and the last time I saw him, I was there with his wife, and he hardly acknowledged I was there. And I felt he knew I was there, but I don't think he wanted me to see him in that way.
Which would kind of fit in with the nature of the relationship.
Yeah, and I kind of regret that I never gave him a big hug and said thanks, Mike. And I thought I didn't think he was coming towards the end, if I'm honest with you. Because the time before I saw him, he was quite sprightly. We were having fun and talking to him. And I thought, yeah, the old git, he'd be at least another 2 or 3 years. Because Mike was old when I met him. Mike looked about 90 when I first met him. He wasn't, but he just never changed. And then when he did get older and deteriorated, I found it really hard. And I regret not seeing him as much as I could have done. But I know he was proud of me, because at his funeral when I spoke, his son had said to me, you do realise my dad was so fond of you. And he spoke about you all the time. So, you know, I don't have regrets with that. My only regret is I didn't give him a massive hug and just say thank you, because if it hadn't been for Mike, I wouldn't have what I have in my life. No way. I wouldn't have achieved anything. He was an amazing man, and, you know, I'm gutted he's gone. But, you know, I only have fond memories of my time with Mike.
Were you closer to Mike than your own father?
No, I wouldn't say that. It was different. It's very different. No. But I saw more of Mike. You know, I'd see Mike 6 days a week, sometimes 7 days a week at training. Mike was like the granddad I never had, sort of thing, I think, more than a father. But as I said, Mike, he was a grumpy sod at times as well. It wasn't all easy, but as I said, I wouldn't have achieved anything without him, and I wouldn't have changed his ways for anything.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc. Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
This is On the Sporting Couch, a programme about mental health issues in sport. I'm psychotherapist Gary Bloom, and my guest here in the studio is former Olympic sprinter Ewan Thomas. Welcome back. You're listening to On the Sporting Couch with me, Gary Bloom, and former Olympic sprinter Ewan Thomas. Because you have what you've described as difficulties, depressions, and so on and so forth, how difficult was that to move into the very public world of TV presenting?
I don't take them with me. I try not to take them with me if I'm doing any work. And yeah, no, I don't want to sit here and sound like I'm doom and gloom. I'm always down, because I'm not. If anything, I'm a little bit the other way. I'm either totally crazy happy, bouncing off the walls, or I'm really down. But normally when I'm really down, I won't show people that side of me.
Why?
Because it's when I'm at home on my own, and it's when I'm when I've got too much time to think. When I'm busy and work and stuff's going well, then I'm normally the chippy chappy, you know?
And that's exactly the point I'm making to you, that you need the speed, the buzz, to keep those very strong emotions at bay. And I'm trying just to dig down and say, what is it? What is the thing that you're frightened of, that the speed covers up those emotions?
I don't know. The fear of failure, maybe? Wanting to be accepted? Wanting to be good at what I do? Not in a materialistic way, just, I don't know, I think it's an acceptance, and maybe that's bad. Maybe I need to just be content, because I have done well in life. You know, I've done all right. I've done well. Someone paid me the biggest compliment once when I remember I'd done a local run in the park, and I was coming back, and this chap stopped me and he goes, "You're all right, you are. I see you down here all the time running. You're 1%, 1%. And I went, "What's that mean?" He goes, "Well, you think how many people around the world who make it as a professional athlete, it's probably 1% of the nation would do that." And I said, "Oh, I suppose so." He said, "Now, you think, since you've retired, how many athletes do you know that have gone on to forge a second career? It's probably 1%, you know, Denise Lewis, Colin Jackson, Jonathan Edwards, a handful of you." And I went, "Yeah, I suppose so." And I never really thought about that. So perhaps I should be a bit more proud and content with what I've done. If it all ends tomorrow, I should still be happy with what I've done. But I don't know, I just feel, I still feel I've got a journey to go. I still feel I've got more to give. And maybe that is because my career was cut so short. Maybe because I didn't have closure as an athlete. Maybe I'm always striving for excellence or to be good. But I don't think that's a bad thing, you see. I don't think it's bad that I'm ambitious. Maybe it's bad that I take rejection or disappointment to heart. But I don't think it's a bad thing that I thrive to be the best that I can be in any walk of life. Whatever people do, to be the best in your career, you've got to sacrifice and you've got to give it everything you've got, unless you're really lucky and you've had a lucky break.
There's an issue I have with that, and it goes like this. You can only be the best you can be on any given day.
Yeah.
Those standards are going to move throughout the day. You know, at 10, 11 o'clock at night, we're not as sharp as we are at 10 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah.
So it's the best you can possibly be at any given time.
Okay.
But I think you create, if you don't mind me saying so, unbelievable standards that you're always going to, now and again, fall short of.
So how do I stop that? How do I lower my standards? When
I think it's about lowering your standard. It's about accepting that you're not going to be 100%.
Oh, no, I do accept that. Don't get me wrong. Like, I do my local park run on a Saturday. It's a 5K. 3 years ago, I'd be coming second. Now I'm getting beaten by 11-year-old boys. You know, I'm no longer the machine I once was. Physically, my body, I'm getting older. I'm getting slower. I know that. So I changed my goalposts. I no longer set myself as hard goals. I set realistic goals. But I just think it's good to have those goals. But like you said, you can only be your best at a certain time of day, and it won't last forever, and I know that. But maybe that's my fear. Maybe this career I'm in now I know won't last forever, so I've got to milk it and do as well as I can now so I can be a content old man in my rocking chair watching 5 DVDs a day.
So what do you hope you're doing in 10 years' time?
I hope by then, well, quicker than that, but I hope by then I'm married with a child, and I think that will change me. You know, all my friends who've got kids, I'm great around them, and I talk to them, and I think perhaps that would be a much better focus for me than wanting to strive to be the best in any job I take on. So, you know, I smile saying it. I look forward to the day that happens, and I think that will change me dramatically. I think all of a sudden I won't be living for myself in the selfish way I've been. I'll be living to be the best dad that I can be.
What sort of dad are you going to be?
Amazing. I'll be a great dad because I'm just a kid myself. I treat my dog like it's a human. I'm surprised I didn't bring him with me today, but I take Frank everywhere with me, and I think I hopefully will be a good dad. I know I'll be strict, and I'll want the best for my child, but I want them, maybe I'll have to ease back, but I want them to be the best that they can be as well. And as long as I can give them that chance in life to follow their dreams, then I think that's what my dad did for me. I'd be proud to do that.
Imagine having a 15, 16-year-old son.
Yep.
He's a keen sprinter.
Yeah.
And he's pushing his body to unbelievable limits and levels.
Yeah.
What would you be saying to him?
I say, you won't be as fast as I was, but listen to your body. No, I would tell him, well, for a start, if he got into athletics, I'd tell him I remember Mike said to me once, we were training, I'll never forget it. He said, in athletics, you've got to work bloody hard to go nowhere at all, and it's a tough sport. And I would tell my son or my daughter that, do whatever sport you want to do, but athletics is tough. But listen to your body. That is my one regret. You know, if things hurt, they hurt for a reason. But you've got to know the difference between a hurt that you can run through because he's being a little lazy sod, or a hurt that's going to damage him. And I do think that's a fine balance, but only my son or my daughter could tell me that. But, you know, there's hurt and there's hurt. You know, as an athlete, you get lactic acid. Your legs do hurt when you're training. It doesn't mean you're going to get injured. You've got to know the difference. But I think I would tell them to learn from my mistakes.
You say listen to your body.
Yep.
What about listen to your mind?
100%.
Because you didn't say that, did you? You said listen to your body.
Well, I think it's a given that the mind is the most powerful tool you possess. And I think as an athlete, unless you are up against a Usain Bolt or Michael Johnson, you're pretty much all of the same ability. It is that person who believes in himself and has the mind strength. But that was my best asset, I think, was my mind. I was very clear when I lined up what I was going to do and how I'd execute my race. And obviously, I don't even know if you can teach that, if I'm honest. I don't know if you can teach what separates someone from being a champion or not. I think we're born that way. So I think you can help someone psychologically as a sportsman or woman to psych up for a race and not get too nervous. But I do think to a certain degree that's something natural. That's my personal opinion.
And as a personal question, really, how soon into that 45 seconds of running, roughly, did you know you were going to win?
Depends what race it was. In the warm-up track, I knew I was going to win in most of my races. This is not disrespectful to my opponents, but the British Championships, or let's take the European Championships. That year, I'd had a really bad season. 1998, Mark Richardson had beaten me 5 times out of 6 around the Grand Prix circuit. I beat him at the trials to make the team. It was a hell of a race. Roger Black didn't even make the team. He ran 44.6, which would have come second, by the way, at the last World Championships, and he came fourth in our British trials. It was tough to make the team back then. And I'd got through the heats, the second round, the semi-final. I remember seeing Mark in the warm-up track, and we'd walk past each other, and I remember I stared him out, and he looked at the ground, and I went back to Mike. I said, I've won. He goes, what do you mean? He's in great shape. I said, no, I've won. I said, I'm in his head already. And that's no disrespect to Mark if he's listening to this. By far the best athlete, most talented athlete I raced against. But I think I had won over on him when it came to the mind. And, you know, I remember you get on the warm-up track, then you get in a little bus that takes you to the main stadium. And I made sure I got on that bus first. And all 7 of those finalists had to walk past me, and I literally eyeballed them all as they sat down. I just let them know that I was here and I was ready. And I ended up winning by over 0.5 seconds, which was a huge margin, and Mark came third. And he should have easily been right with me. But I think, psychologically, I'd won the battle before we'd even heard on your marks. And as I said, when things are going well, I mentally was tough. I wasn't horrible, don't get me wrong. I wouldn't go around swearing at people before you're about to race, but I'd let them know I was ready. I'd stare them out. I would not stop looking at them.
I'd like to discuss in the last part of our conversation about people who might be listening to this programme who are going through dark times at the moment, especially people who are very interested in sport, and of course that's the majority of our audience. What message would you give to them, not necessarily budding sports people, but young men or women who are struggling with psychological issues right now?
You're not alone. You are not alone. You'll feel alone at the moment if you don't talk about it. You'll feel that, why you? And it's weird because you'll think how I thought if you say to someone, I'm feeling really depressed. What have you got to be depressed about? That's the answer you think you might get, but you won't. There's so many people out there who have tough times. Just reach out. I'll talk to them if they want. Honestly, just get in touch because, you know, what's the saying? A problem's halved, there's a problem shared, there's a problem solved. I don't know. Whatever they're saying is, just talk, because I think there has been a stigma around it before where you think there's something wrong with you if you get depressed, or, you know, why can't you see the light? Why are you always feeling so low? But you'll be so surprised the amount of people, maybe people who you respect and look up to, who feel the same as you. They just might not show it. So I think just talk to people. It doesn't matter if it's your mates down the pub, it's a colleague at work, if it's a stranger. There's so many different charities and helplines out there. Just talk to someone, because it's normal. I think it's normal. Honestly, I think it's normal to feel low. I can't see how you can go through life always feeling totally upbeat. And as I said, if you do, then bottle that and sell it, because you're lucky if you've got that in your life. Because I think we'll all come across times, you know, I think the cruelest thing in life is when things are going great and then all of a sudden something happens, whether there's a bereavement or you lose a job or a relationship breaks down. Just when things feel like they're going great, something comes in life and it kicks you between the legs and you just think, why? But it happens to all of us. So you've just got to get back on that bike and just talk to someone.
Interestingly, sport is a great antidote to feeling low, and actually physical exercise is one of the best things that anybody can prescribe.
It's brilliant, and I love nothing more than when I go for a run around the streets of Southampton to see other people running, and it's almost like that brotherhood when you say hiya. And there's all shapes and sizes. I'm not being disrespectful. Where I run, there's quite a large woman who always runs around, and I'm always thinking, fair play to you, because there's a lot of people who might have weight issues and think, I can't go to the gym, people will laugh at me, or I can't go out and go running, I'm really slow. So what? Just get out there and do something. Set yourself a little target, whether it's walk for 5 minutes, jog for 2 minutes, then build it up. And I think sport makes you feel great all the time. When I'm feeling low, and I'll message a couple of guys I run with just for fun, and I'll text them and say, I'm not feeling it today, guys, I can't be bothered. And they knock on my door, say, all right, get your shoes on. And I come back from that run and I'm like, oh, cheers, guys, thanks for making me get out, because I feel great now. And you do. There's obviously the scientific proof. It releases endorphins or whatever it is, makes you feel good. But whatever it is, it does make you feel good when you do exercise. And I think also team sports are brilliant, to get out there and have a laugh. You know, you'd have to be the best football, hockey player, rugby player. If you enjoy being with people and you want to keep fit, go and find a sport that suits you. And I think that is the beauty of sport nowadays. All shapes and sizes, doesn't matter your ability. Get out there and find something that you enjoy doing, because it's good to get out there in the fresh air and do something. It makes you feel alive. I'm going running tonight. I've already planned it before I came here. I'm doing hill sessions, something I do as an athlete. It's going to kill me. Oh, there we go, back to that being... I can't even say that word.
Masochist.
Masochist. There's my masochism coming back out. But no, I'm going training tonight. I'm doing 10 hills off 2 minutes recovery, and I know after three I'm going to be in pain, but I'll be smiling at the end of it.
Ewan Thomas, masochist supreme, many thanks for joining me on The Sporting Couch.
Pleasure. I've got to learn how to say that word, haven't I?
You've been listening to On the Sporting Couch, a programme that attempted to lift the lid on mental health issues in sport. I'm Gary Bloom, a psychotherapist, counsellor and sports broadcaster, and my guest has been former Olympic sprinter Ewan Thomas. I hope the programme will have encouraged anyone who has or knows anyone who has mental health issues to come forward and get help. And there are some useful links on the TalkSport website if you look at talksport.com/sportingcouch. I'm Gary Bloom, and please remember, there's no such thing as good health without good mental health. Goodbye.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.